Hi, I'm Bob Fisher, and I'm your host today on This is Design Intelligence. David Lau is an accomplished leader and serves as a senior instructor with the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center Leadership Institute. He is a combat veteran and regularly speaks on resilience, wellness, anti-fragility, and post-traumatic growth. On this edition of This is Design Intelligence, he talks about his life-changing deployment to Afghanistan, the examples of leadership that continue to influence him, and how a traumatic event can actually be a springboard to a deeper, richer, more fulfilling life. As part of David's story, today's episode includes some graphic descriptions of combat that may not be suitable for all listeners.
Welcome to this edition of This is Design Intelligence, conversations with leadership voices in the built environment.
David Lau, welcome to This is Design Intelligence. It's an honor to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
You know, David, you're a bit of an unusual guest compared to a lot of the other folks we have on the podcast. It's not every day that we have a senior instructor from FLETC Leadership Institute. And so for everybody who doesn't get the government acronyms, FLETC stands for Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. This is only one of many intriguing things that you've done in your career that lead to an equally intriguing set of ideas about resilience and effective leadership. So I want to start by asking you, what is it that you're doing today and how did you get to where you are?
So I teach and facilitate education on leadership concepts, and that can run the spectrum from how to lead through understanding human behavior to how to take care of yourself to how do we resolve conflict. Is that conflict resource and material based, or is it in fact conflict of personalities? How do we identify someone's individual values or the values of a group so that when we're trying to inspire people, right, we can calibrate our language so it goes directly into their hearts because it's a shared vision? And this is something that I've always found enthralling, because leadership is one of the few areas in our professional education that truly transcend the occupation and they transcend the profession. I mean, if you boil down sound leadership principles, honestly, we should start teaching these concepts in elementary school, right? Like everything that you would think of how a good leader should conduct themselves, how they should be day in, day out. This is what you would want your kids to do. So it's a philosophical discussion. It is a science, and it's something that can and should be a healthy part of the water cooler conversation.
Yeah, there is a friend of mine who went through Sandhurst in the UK, and he said one of the first lessons that they taught him was, first, you must learn to lead yourself before you learn to lead others.
This is directly from Aristotle, right? Aristotle said, before you lead others, you have to lead yourself. But before you can even lead yourself, you have to know yourself. And that always starts with a discussion on your values.
So a lot of what you talk about with folks, or at least that I'm familiar with, is on these topics of resilience and anti-fragility and kind of a flourishing forward through the difficult times that inevitably come with leadership. So tell me about those ideas. Let's get kind of a common definition that we can share for what those are, and then maybe some of the other key ideas that are part of the teaching that you do.
Okay. So I think the term resilience, obviously everybody knew what it was, but I think specifically once we entered into the age of COVID, right? I mean, this now it really rises to the top. There's all types of books being put out on there, and it's a concept that goes by other names. I mean, some people call it durability. Some people might call it grit. Some people might call it psychological hardiness. They all kind of mean the same thing. So when we're talking about resilience, what we're talking about is the ability to store and recover energy in the whole person concept when something happens. Probably the most commonly understood definition of resilience. If you ask somebody, what is resilient? You'll probably hear this. It's the ability to bounce back. It's the ability to come back and recover to the state that you were at after something happens. And by the way, that something that we know will happen. It doesn't matter if it happens on duty or off duty. You know, we hear this a lot. Everybody has heard this phrase. You've got to leave home at home and you've got to leave work at work. And most people have figured out long ago that is absolutely impossible because there is only one you, and you carry your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions with you everywhere you go. You don't just flip them off because you go home.
You know, it's interesting when you were talking about the definition of resilience that you use, you say, hey, most people talk about it as the ability to bounce back. There's a guy named Joe Fixell. I believe he's retired now, but he was at, I believe, Ohio State University, wrote a book where his definition of resilience was the ability to not only withstand a shock, but to come back stronger or better than you were originally, not just to return to your original state, but actually come back in a new and better position.
I like that. I know that is post-traumatic growth, right? Because there is actually a timeline on that recovery. Let's say something happens that rocks you in your world, whatever that may be. Something happens at work, loss of a job, loss of a relationship that you mourn as a death because in your heart, something died and you're going to mourn it as such, right? And you're just not yourself for a few weeks, but eventually you come back to where you were. That's most people's understanding of resilience, but there's actually a timeline on that recovery. And the DSM-5, which is the manual that psychological professionals use, pegged that timeline at approximately 6 months, right? So if trauma befalls you and 6 months passes and you are not back where you were before it hit, and maybe it wasn't a physical event, right? Maybe there's moral, psychological, emotional wounding, and there's certain things going on with you in clusters. You go in to see somebody to say, hey, what's going on with me? You could be diagnosed with something called post-traumatic stress, and we're all aware of what that is. But when you flourish forward and you use that event as a springboard to a deeper, richer, more fulfilling life where you actually have a better life after that event because of it, not in spite of it, that is the clinical definition of post-traumatic growth, which humans have been experiencing this ever since we've been around, but that actual term entered into the lexicon in the late 1980s.
You mean post-traumatic growth did?
Yes.
So what is it that separates in an individual an experience that where someone has post-traumatic stress that is not post-traumatic growth versus post-traumatic growth?
I can only answer based upon the papers that I've read and my experience and the experience of other people who I've gone through life with. Like all of us, right? We start to gather our values and come up with our own code way of living when we're children, right? When we're kids, you learn these things at the dinner table. Most of us do. And the way that my father was the largest personality in the lives of me and my siblings by far. And like a lot of our parents, like, you know, he had it pretty rough as a kid and he wanted his kids to have it better than he did. But the trick is keeping those kids grateful, right? Like that's the dilemma of every parent. Every parent wants their kids to have things that they can only dream of, but how do you make them appreciate the fact that if you wanted to learn something as a kid, you literally had to get on your bike and know the Dewey Decimal System and ride to the library, right? Those days are gone. So my life experiences would start when I was a kid. My dad's dad, my grandfather, immigrated here, and classic immigrant story, right? Barely spoke English. And married my grandmother, who was an indigenous, she was like the last generation of Hawaiians that had to learn English. She grew up only speaking Hawaiian. She had to go to a boarding school to learn English. So together, they could only communicate in maybe equivalent of a third grade level English. And he's just trying to make his way and had a little farm in a town called Waimanalo. And he was actually delivering some of his groceries to Pearl Harbor when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And so he was there. He uses his farm truck. He helps. He does what he can. He moves wounded sailors around. He comes home. And the effects of that day left him so in awe of American bravery that he made a rule. He said, as long as the Lau family lives in the United States, every generation has to provide one child for the military forever. Like, this is how I'm going to pay this country for accepting me and bringing me in. So from the time that I can understand language, my dad would just be in my ear saying, you know, you have done absolutely nothing for you to get your U.S. citizenship. Your grandpa did that for you. But one day, when you turn 18, you're going to ante up, you're going to chip in, and you're going to do whatever you can to try to earn it. And my grandfather's tradition that he set, right, the way that you earned it was through selfless service. So these lessons started when I was young, and my destiny, so to speak, was kind of already written for me, right? So I entered the military at a young age. The earliest, at least then, the earliest that you could sign up was 16 and a half, and the earliest that you could leave was 17 and a half. I graduated high school early, and I was 17 and a half, and I was out. I started basic training. I entered into the Army.
And what job did you do there?
You do a lot of jobs when you join the Army. I mean, you do whatever needs done. So I originally enlisted as a scout, and then I went to civil affairs school, and I did civil affairs for a while. And then I came back from a deployment with civil affairs. I was working with some special forces guys, and I'm like, man, I really like the latitude that they get. I like how they get the mission and they get to plan their own missions, and they do it, you know, how they see is the best way, as long as they get the job done and it's moral and ethical and legal. So when I came back from a deployment with the civil affairs unit, I went to special forces assessment and selection tryouts. I got selected and joined the SF unit. And then I was with those guys for the rest of my time in the military, about 7 years.
All right. And so how much total time did you have?
I retired with 21 total years, 10 years active component, and then 11 years in guarded reserve units.
And during that time, you did some deployments that taught you a lot about these ideas of leadership that we're discussing here.
That's right. I went to Afghanistan, actually went twice, which isn't a lot. I know I've got buddies that they've been deployed 16 times, some more. But I benefited greatly from the organization that sent me there because they were outside the box thinkers. We were trained very unconventionally. For example, some of the things that we would do is they would have us sit around and just literally bare your soul. They're like, hey guys, when we go down there, like, we're under no illusions. You know, by this point, we had already buried many members of our unit that had, you know, gone there in Iraq. And they're like, hey, we're under no illusions. We are going to prepare you tool set, skill set, the very best that we can, right? You're going to get the best training in the world. You're going to have the best equipment in the world, but that's not enough, right? The mindset and the heart set have got to be there. And that starts with the why. You know, what is it that you are willing to go through anything to make it home through? So on occasion, we would bare our souls to each other. You know, we would say, hey, listen, this is what I will push my body beyond recognized medical limits. I will drive this thing till it falls off the rails to make it home to. This is what I'm willing to do that for. And for everybody, the answer is different, but a common thread is that answer has always got to be about something greater than self. It's always got to be about something bigger than us.
Well, when you're over in Afghanistan for the last time, What was that cause that for you was bigger than self? And for the people that you were working with, especially your Afghan counterparts, what was their purpose bigger than self?
So for me, I remember clearly, it was the day that I was getting ready to leave the house. 16-pack van is coming from the unit to pick me up and collect us up and take us to the airport. And my mom is there to see me off, and the sun hasn't come up yet. And I'm just walking around the house, drinking coffee, waiting for the van to pull up in so I can jump in it. And I can already hear my mom's down the hall in the guest room, and she's already crying. Like, I can, you know, she can't even bear to come out and look at me, right? But my wife is holding it together pretty good. So my wife, she's from a place that used to be called Yugoslavia. So she was a refugee. She had to leave, right? They had to leave in the middle of the night. You know, they never knew if they were going to make it past checkpoints, if they would ever be able to go home again. She's had family members end up in mass graves. So she knows more than most people what war is and what it can do. And she would never ask me to make a promise that I'm going to come home again, because when you go to war as a combatant, just don't ask somebody to make that promise, because it's not really up to them. So my mom came out and she asked me to do that. She said, son, she was, promise me you're going to come home. And I said, Mom, I promise you guys, if anything tries to keep me from coming home at the end of this, I will fight, I will stab, I will claw my way through anything. And if I happen to come home in a box wrapped up in our flag, I want you to know that I literally fought to the last breath, to the last drop of blood to make it home to you guys. And she was like, all right, I'll take that. And off I went. And we'll talk about it later. But, you know, the day that I made that promise came back in my mind in living color in every detail when I thought about quitting.
So, David, once you got to Afghanistan, I know from other conversations and other talks that you've done that you were embedded with Afghan forces and developed some very strong relationships and saw some wonderful examples of leadership in the people that you worked with. Tell us a little bit about the people that you work with and what you saw that helped you form your ideas around leadership.
Yeah, so this was also called the Afghan Brother Mission. So you would have an American advisor, which I was one, and you get assigned, you're tied to the hip to some senior Afghan officials. My Afghan counterpart was a man named Ghulam Saki. I'm actually looking at his picture right now in my study. I have a framed photo of him up. And just an exceedingly brave, gracious, humble, courageous individual. I mean, in any culture, in any nation, this would be someone who, within 5 minutes of meeting him, you want to be a part of whatever he has going on. It's just how he carried himself. Like he would walk into a room and there would be no fighting, no danger going on, but he would just walk into a room and all of his guys, they would just stand up a little bit straighter, you know? Or, I mean, we've been in situations where it was getting dicey, it was getting rugged. And when he would come onto the scene, you could just feel this collective courage. He was just that kind of guy with those qualities. It was how he carried himself in every interaction. I think about him all the time as this example. When we're talking about leadership, leadership is just as much in the little in-between moments. It's in every interaction, right? It's who is the boss going to lunch with? Who is the boss not going to lunch with, right? Like, how are you interacting with people in every little moment? That's when you're building your leadership legacy and showing people how you want them to be. And just a little example of him. Everyone's heard of the concept of leaders eat last, right? Simon Sinek wrote a book about it. He wrote that book based upon his experience with the United States military, right? This is something that we've done in the military ever since we've had a military. And that's how leaders of the military are raised, right? Like you don't have water, whatever, you know, until your troops are taken care of. It doesn't mean you literally cannot eat until they do because you got to eat when you got to eat, but they have to be your primary consideration, right? You can't have anything they don't have. When I showed up, I had a plate carrier for him, like body armor. In this part of town that we were working in the city, there was a lot of suicide bombings. This terrorist organization that we were pursuing, which was a Taliban affiliate, they were very good at suicide bombing and somewhere there and gotten their hands on a lot of high-grade explosive. So he's definitely a assassination target. We know it. We have the intel on it. I bring him a plate carrier, which was at that time like the best plate carrier you could get. Only certain people had it. I brought it to him. I said, I've got you something. I'm very excited to give this to you. You know, I pulled it out the bag. I said, listen, I'm like, whenever we're patrolling out the streets, I would really like it if you would wear this because, you know, you're a high value target for them. And in order for us to turn this city around, it's you. Like you are going to put the city on your shoulders. And he looked at me and he smiled and he's like, thank you. Thank you so much. And then he said this, he goes, I will gladly wear that when you get me about 300 more. Because he had about 300 people working underneath him. And he was saying, I am not going to wear anything that they don't have. Like, I'm not going to walk out with this thing that can protect me and save my life, and they don't have it. So he said, yeah, I'd love to wear it. Get me 300 more. Because when my lowest ranking person has one, then I'll wear it. And that is something that you expect out of an American commander, because that's our culture. But that is not Afghan culture. That's just a difference in the cultures. They traditionally, they are not a leaders eat last type culture. They are a leaders eat first, second, thirds. I fill up the Tupperware. And if there's anything left over, right, then I kick it on down the line. That's just how it is. So for him to do that
And he would always do things like that, right? That just spoke to the kind of guy that he was. And if that nation were to ever turn around, it's going to be on the backs of people like him, but not specifically him, because he was killed working right beside me. And on the day that he was killed, he didn't have to be out there patrolling. Because of his position and his rank, he was echelons above patrolling the street on foot, which is exactly what we were doing that day. But I had a couple of Americans with me that they were going to meet with some city leaders, and he just wanted to be there with us. He would do these on occasion just to share hardship with his guys, because he knew how far that would go with morale. And, you know, that's something that we share with leaders is, you know, every time you get promoted, it is a new job, right? You got promoted because you were good at doing one thing. Well, now you have a completely different set of responsibilities, and you can't always like jump back into it and grind with the crew that you used to grind with. However, if you can do it on occasion, right, it's a huge morale booster. So he would continue to do that. And believe me, nobody would have thought any different of him if he would have just stayed in his office.
Right. But he was embracing the same danger that he was asking people to face.
Without body armor. Yeah. We weren't patrolling on vehicles with AC. We were out there walking in a very, very busy city with a lot of dangerous elements in it.
So what happened?
So we were patrolling the city of Maimana, and it was market day. Market day over there is generally Thursday. Friday is an observed holy day, so generally it's Thursday. And usually on market day, there is a unwritten agreement that nobody's going to shoot at anybody, right? So Afghanistan, unfortunately, it is a very ethnically fractured society. There's five basic main ethnicities in that country. Some of them get along fine, and other ones, they have beefs that go back before Alexander the Great was there, and they are still trying to settle them. That's just how it is. So when you go into the city on market day, you're looking for atmospherics. And one of those things that you're looking for is everybody here? Are all the ethnicities represented, young and old? Because if any one of those groups is missing, that's a red flag. So everybody was there. We're patrolling. The skies were crystal clear. It was a beautiful day. My interpreter was on my right side, Zahor, who, by the way, had just gotten approved for a visa to emigrate to the United States due to his faithful service to us. And Ghulam Saki was on my left side. And I literally said out loud, this day could not be going any better. And as soon as those words left my mouth, a 13-year-old male had walked in our patrol with a 25-pound suicide vest. That is a massive vest. 25 pounds of high-grade explosives wrapped around his torso, covered in ball bearings 360. The ball bearings were impregnated with poison. He walked into our patrol and detonated. He was about 10 feet behind me. Killed three Americans that I had with me on the spot. Sean Hannon, Nick Rosansky, Jeff Rick. Killed five Afghan partners that we were patrolling with. Killed my interpreter, who was on my right shoulder, and my Afghan brother, Ghulam, on my left shoulder. Just killed them instantly. I was closest person to the bomb that lived it. Massive loss of life. 11 civilians died right there. And a lot more died later. And I know this because I was mistaken as an Afghan, and I had longer hair and a mustache. And Afghan civilians dragged me away to their hospital where they were bringing all the civilian casualties. And we were just all in a big room. There's people dying everywhere. And just one of those days that are imprinted, the most vivid memory I have.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. So how were you able to physically survive this? Because your injuries were pretty severe.
They were very severe. And I can't take any credit for my survival. I was a role player in it. So in the hierarchy of training, right, the two things that get almost all of the glory and credit are tool set and skill set. And if you look over most industries, most professions, the professional education or training is tool set and skill set centric. And if you want to be world class, you have to have those at a world class level, right? Whatever the tool may be, whether it's software, whether it's a law, if you're a lawyer, tools always change. Equipment, gear, technology, laws, rules, regulations, they always change. How do we employ them effectively? That's the skill. right? And the organizations that are world-class, they do it at a world-class level. They're always ahead of the game. So we drill a lot with the tools and skills, right? Tools, you know, tourniquets, radios, firearms, language, the ability to use it, skill. So when I woke up, because the blast knocked me out, it threw me forward into the street. So I wake up in the middle of the street. I pick my head up. I know where I am. I just don't know why I'm sleeping in the middle of the street. And I wasn't breathing, because when you're that close to the bomb makes a blast wave. And that's the most destructive part of any bomb. That's what can flip a tank over. That's what levels buildings. And then comes the fragmentation, and then comes the thermal effect. And then the blast wave creates a vacuum, and then it collapses on itself and it sucks debris back in, and you hit twice. So if you survive that, it rattles your brain, it knocks you out. It feels like you've been uppercutted by Mike Tyson. So I'm struggling to breathe. As soon as I inhaled, I take a deep breath. And as soon as I inhaled, I smelled it. Everything that explodes has its own scent. And once you smell it, you'll never forget it. And as soon as I inhaled it, I knew right away. I was like, oh, they got us. And I went to flip myself over, because I'm still the leader, right? Like, just because I'm hurt doesn't mean that all of my responsibilities go away. No, I still have a job to do. So I tried to flip myself over to get to my back, and my legs weren't working. And I used my arms to, you know, sling my body over to take a look at what was going on. And a lot of things happened at the same time, but I know I got to fix myself, because you are your own medic. And the bomb blew my combat pants right off me. I had like a little short camouflage loincloth left for like my pants, which is exactly what you need, because you have to see what's going on. And my legs were tore up. It blew my right femur out of my leg. My right thigh was inverted. It just like a chunk of meat. It was inside out. My left leg was almost completely severed at the knee. It was just hanging on. My lower leg was hanging on by some tissue at the back of my knee. I couldn't see my artery in my right thigh, but out of this mass of meat, I could see the blood trying to spurt out. And I was laying in a massive pool of blood. So I was probably out for about a minute. You can only survive a femoral arterial cut for 90 seconds before you're going to pass out. So I was probably out, I don't know, maybe over a minute, just judging by how much blood I was laying in. Right away, I knew if I don't fix this one problem now, there are no more problems. And that's stopping my own bleeding. Right. So tool set. So, you know, we drill this until you reach a level of what's called unconscious competence. It takes up no cognitive bandwidth to do this skill, right? It's simple. It's like driving a route home. You've driven home a million times. So my brain is like, okay, tourniquet, go. And I'm trying to get the tourniquet off my plate carrier. You do all this without looking. So I'm looking around, I'm shouting at guys. I'm hearing gunshots go off. You know, where are they coming from? Are they going to try to drag one of us off? I'm trying to get the tourniquet off my plate carrier, and I just can't get it off. And I finally looked down. I looked at my hand, and my hand was skeletal. Like, that bomb blast took one of my fingers off, and all the meat from two other fingers were hanging down by my elbow. I could look right through my hand, like shiny white bone. I could look right through my hand. I said, well, tourniquet, left hand, go. Boom. And I started to do it with my left hand, but my shoulder was dislocated. My left shoulder had been dislocated when I got thrown through the air, I guess. So I was basically trying to short arm and chicken wing these tourniquets onto my leg. And that's the skill set, right? Like, that skill for whatever you're doing has to be trained to a level of unconscious competence. Mindset. I can honestly say, and I can also take zero credit for this, I never panicked, because we would do positive visualization every day. You know, so although I'd only been blown up this one time in real life, I'd already war gamed this in my head in detail, step by step, what I would do literally hundreds of times. Because even back then, we would train to tap into neuroplasticity, right? We call it mental OODA looping, observe, orient, decide, and act. And we would put ourselves in these situations. You get blown up, you get shot, like you're patrolling down the street, you wake up, you're in the middle of the road. Both legs and an arm is gone. And then we would say, tell me how you're going to win. And we would talk it out step by step in detail. And when you do that, in as short as one session, you tap into the phenomenon of neuroplasticity. Your brain starts to literally build new neural pathways. You do it enough, the myelin sheets get thicker and thicker. There's no panic, right? Now, it happens in real life. Your brain already knows what to do. It takes up almost no cognitive bandwidth. So I knew what to do. And because, like I said, I was still the patrol leader. I still had things I needed to tend to. And it was like my left arm just automatically fixed myself. I didn't even have to think. I didn't have to use any conscious thought for that to happen because we were so well prepared for this. But I had to tap into heart set. We all did. But for me, when I was laying there and I'm hearing shots go off and my rifle's blown off, my radio's blown off, I still had my pistol, but my right hand was out of order. My left shoulder was dislocated. I couldn't even cross draw. So as I'm putting my tourniquets on, I kept passing out. I would pass out. I would wake up. I would pass out. I would wake up. And when you lose that much blood, the level of sleepiness that I felt is indescribable. When I try to explain it to people, the only way I can even get close is if I tell them, if you've ever had a surgery where they had to give you anesthesia, right? And you're like all scrubbed up and right, and then the anesthesiologist comes and he or she says, all right, here comes the good stuff. And they give you that pump and they say, start to 10 and count backwards. I say, how close do you get to zero? Well, if they know what they're doing, you probably get to 9, right? Or 8. I'll say, hit pause at that last conscious moment. Like right when you feel like this inescapable sleep is getting ready to pull you in, hit pause. And like, that's it right there. Like you just want to sleep. And,
but you knew you needed to resist. You knew you needed to find something within yourself to not fall asleep.
That's it. I mean, but I did think about taking, you know, there's nothing more I could do. And I thought for a moment, I said, you know, this is rugged. Like there's nothing more I can do. I thought, you know, I know my partner who's on the other side of the city. I said, I know he heard it going off. And if him and the other guys are alive, they are running here right now as fast as they can to save the day. So for a brief moment, I thought, I'm going to put my head back, take a nap and wake up someplace chill like Kandahar or Bagram and find myself rescued. But like you said, my next thought was, you take that nap, you're not waking up ever. So my mind took me to the day that I left my house. And it, in vivid color, it took me to the promise that I made to my mom and my wife that I would fight till the last breath and the last drop of blood to come home. It made me get mad. I felt like there were people trying to take me away from my family. And I was not afraid of dying, but I was thinking about, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, big holidays for us, cookouts, high school graduations, and I'm not there. The chair that I always sit in, empty. And how that's going to crush people. I got mad. I thought, man, these guys do not have the right to take me from my family. I fought, right? I fought. That's when I started fighting to stay awake. And I had to stay awake for a long time because the day got crazy from there.
But ultimately, you wound up finding your way to NATO forces, right?
Yes.
And ultimately, they helped stabilize you medically and get you out of the country.
That's right. I communicated with the guy who, the doctor of the Afghan hospital that I was dragged to. I just happened to have met him doing something else like 3 days earlier. I was there for a while. He facilitated my transport to a Norwegian camp on the north end of the city. I didn't know what was going on. I got thrown in the back of there and this cab driver just took off and I was completely defenseless. So I'm back there rolling around just praying. I was like, please let this guy be on the level because there was, he could have gave me to the Talons. He could have sold me to drug gangs. There was nothing I could have done about it. But he risked his life, right, to take me to the Norwegian camp. And we almost got shot going to the gate anyways. I got there. I got reunited with the rest of my team. And that started my medevac route to get out of the country and eventually back to the States.
Eventually, you were able to make it to NATO forces, and they helped you get out of the country, and then there was a long period of recovery.
Yes. I was a patient at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio for about 3 years.
3 years. 3 years in the hospital the whole time?
Not the whole time. I was probably inpatient for a total of 6 months, mm-hmm. and then the other 2.5 were returning to the hospital every day for physical therapies, you know, more limb salvage surgeries. They try to get you out of the hospital as fast as you can. Like if you can get out, if they can put you in an electric wheelchair and get you out, and then you just come back every day for treatments, that's what they try to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and your recovery was long, but you know, you do physical training instruction to this day, right? So
yes.
You somehow found a way to come back to a pretty high level of performance. How did that happen?
A lot of that happened what we call left of bank. It was in the preparation, right? If you want to flourish forward from these events, to give yourself the best chances, you have to start long before that event, which you don't know what's on the horizon, but you know something is going to happen, right? Prepare for it. Everybody finds out very quickly that pain in this life is not optional, but long-term suffering is. So we trained holistically, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. You have to be strong in all those four concepts because we're synergistic, right? Like you take a physical injury, whatever that may be, you get a cancer diagnosis, whatever, you know, you get some type of health malady. Scientifically, that only affects you physically. But if it is bad enough, if it's scary enough, it will also affect you mentally and emotionally as well. And the other side of the coin is also true. If you're in a constantly mentally and emotionally stressed, maybe even, heaven forbid, a toxic environment, that will affect you physically unless that's mitigated, right? So if you want to recover from any type of harm, whether it's a moral wounding, a psychological wounding, or a physical wounding, the recovery has to be holistic, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. So every day in my recovery, I would try to do, at the end of each night when I would lay down, I would go through like a checklist in my head and I'll say, what have I done today to make myself better physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually? Like, have I worked out? Have I eaten good? Have I gotten good rest? Have I called a friend who I love? Have I offered somebody forgiveness? Have I asked for forgiveness? Have I done right according to my friends who gave their last full measure, right? Like, am I living a life that would make them proud? At the end of every day, I would go through this. That was just a process that I did, right? To try to make sure I was keeping myself on track.
Right. So you were very intentional about it and you tracked it all the way and you saw yourself on a journey of recovery and flourishing forward.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would do future forecast journaling. Right. I would journal every day. And sometimes I would journal like what a day in the life, but it was 1 year in the future. This is when I was still in a wheelchair. Right. I was like, okay, went for a 5 mile run today, felt good, came back. You know, I did like, I would write what I wanted my day to be 1 year from now. At the end of the day, like it had already happened. So I would set these things as goalposts for me to hit. And it wasn't all me. I mean, I got fantastic care, but I tried very hard to be a good patient. Like I was with a neurologist. My brain was damaged so badly, I lost a lot of my memory. I had to learn how to talk again. So when my neurologist would tell me something, as badly damaged as my brain was, I knew I gotta listen to her. Like she knows what she's talking about. And a huge part of it was my family. My kids were young, but I didn't want them to see me walking around with my head defeated, which is tempting to do, right? There's a lot of temptation for survivor's guilt and the novelty of being alive wears off pretty quick. And then there's just this very easy hall pass, if you will, to live this life of self-pity. Like, woe is me. How could this happen to me? But I would look at my kids and I'd be like, and I was very cognizant of the fact that even though I'm in this chair, I'm Superman to these kids. You know, like, I don't think that of myself, but that's what they think. And if they see me groveling, you know, if they see me self-medicating or whatever else could be tempting to do, how much that's going to affect them.
So your experiences were kind of at the extreme of what a human can go through and come out the other side. And a lot of that had to do with you were in a life and death kind of profession. But now you work with people who are not working in those particular types of environments. They're people who are in more, I guess you could call them conventional leadership roles, much like folks who are, you know, in the audience for this podcast. How is it that individual leaders can use the kind of ideas that you're talking about?
Well, I think the first stop is just awareness that individual resilience begets organizational resilience. And sometimes you'll see organizations, we have these in the government, right? And we know better, where for better or for worse, an individual person can become a single point of failure, meaning so much knowledge and so much function can cycle through, get choke pointed through one person. If that one individual, if something happens, whatever that may be, and they can't show up on any given day, the machine can grind to a halt, right? That's a single point of failure. So we're like, you can't let that happen. Like, you have a leadership responsibility to make sure that doesn't happen. So that means people beneath you need to know your job in case you can't come up. And number one, you got to take care of yourself, because an empty well gives no water. And oftentimes we'll see in a lot of jobs where somebody, especially a senior leader, their Monday through Friday, their modus operandi just becomes from the minute they wake up to the minute they go to bed exhausted, they just grind, rushing from one emergency to the next. And they think that's what's required. And they are always in a state of pre-exhaustion. Well, if that's how you always operate, that is exactly how you will show up when the big thing happens with your organization or your family. So the first thing is to recognize you can't be single point of failure, and to let this lifestyle of resilience that will beget post-traumatic growth become a part of the culture, right? And the words that we say, the things that are up on the wall, words have power, and what we accept and what we condone. I'm a big advocate of required reading. Well, it's hard to require somebody to do something, right? But like, reading lists, give them articles. The unit that I retired from, this is a military organization, we had a required reading list that we had to read every year. It was give or take 20 books. And most of them weren't tactical fighting books. Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl's Say Yes to Life, Marcus Aurelius' Meditations, right? The Ernest Shackleton's Endurance, written by Alfred Lansing. The Body Keeps the Score, which is a fantastic book on how mental trauma can start physical trauma. And so we had to read these things, right? And then we would ask each other, and our commanders would ask us, hey, you're getting ready to go on this deployment. You've read this book. What are some of your takeaways, right? So, and a lot of these things were on resilience and flourishing forward and taking care of your family. But that was always a part of the culture. That's what was expected. We would have to read articles. And a big thing is to let people know that don't be ashamed to need help, right? Marcus Aurelius writes this in Meditations. He says, don't be ashamed to need help. Like a soldier storming a wall, you have a mission to accomplish. And if you've been wounded and you need a comrade to lift you up, so what? And he wasn't talking about moral wounding, right? We would have that quote up on the wall as like a constant reminder. Like, yes, you guys are barrel-chested freedom fighters. Yes, we understand. However, don't be ashamed to reach out if you need help, because we're all going to do it. So things that are common threads, what have I carried with me from that way of life to what I am now, which is basically I'm in an admin role now, right? Well, what has it changed? Well, the why and the purpose of why I do these things have not changed, right? You work in an office. You could have 20 people in that office. Every one of them is going to have their own reason why they come in on the days that they do not feel like coming in. So as a leader, sometimes I'm big on a leader needs to be very intimate with what their organizational values are. Like, why do we exist as an organization? What do we stand for? What are we here for? And when somebody comes in as a one-on-one conversation with that person, especially if they're a junior leader, right? Ask them this question. Why do you want to be part of us? Which is sounds like a generic interview question, but an even better question is, what is that fuel that's going to have you come in here? Because there's going to be days that you don't want to come in. Like, honestly, what are you doing this for? Or what is it that you get up out of bed every day for and you do life for? Get people to talk about their values. And that could start when they were young, when they were raised. What's the most important thing to them? And then as leaders, try to show them how their values align with our organizational values. Because if you can do that, you will have almost an extra gear towards the energy that you give for that organization. If you can see the bigger picture of why you're doing it and all the good that you're doing. My father was a manual laborer, primarily roofs, right? So that's seasonal. You know, we lived in the northern part of the United States during my childhood. It gets snowy, it's cold, right? But he would always say this, like in any construction crew, the guy tearing down the roofs, he's an afterthought, right? Like the sub brings that guy in. But my dad would say, no, he would tell his crew, if we don't do this right, this roof is going to leak. If this roof leaks, the family that buys this house, you know how much that's going to put them out of pocket if they got to do that? Like, kids aren't going to get shoes. And he would literally go down this list of, unless you put this tar paper down correctly, like, families are going to suffer, right? So you better make sure that you're doing it right, because we're keeping families warm and dry. That's how my dad approached roofing, right? Like, I don't want to call it a lower rung manual labor job, but that's what it is. I mean, I did it when I was a kid. But even with a job like that, like, my father saw the greater good in what he was doing. And that kind of helped him give energy to go out there and do it when the weather was horrible, when his hands hurt, right? When his arthritis was acting up. So sometimes as leaders, we have to help people find their why, because not everybody's going to have that conversation with themselves.
Yeah. So it's all at the end of the day about your own values and how well those align with the organization and what sense of purpose you have and maybe what kind of purpose the organization helps you find or the what kind of purpose that organization has.
Yes. Yes. And if you can find a way to make those align, you have an extra gear of energy towards that task.
Well, David, it's been a great honor to talk to you. We really appreciate the time that you've spent with us and everything you've shared about leadership. And thank you so much for your service.
It was good to see you again. Thanks for having me. I appreciate all that you guys do.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of This is Design Intelligence. The producer is Laura Spells. The sound engineer is Jared Knabel. This has been a DI Media Group production.